Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a leaked memo obtained by the Washington Post indicating a major shift in U.S. policy over Syria, which apparently is being negotiated in Moscow between Secretary of State Kerry and President Putin. Joshua Landis, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, who writes the daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics, Syria Comment, joins us to discuss the extent to which the U.S. is planning to sell out the moderate Syrian opposition and prolong the Assad family's hold on a country they are largely responsible for destroying. With the Secretary of Defense opposing this policy shift, we'll examine the internal battles within the Obama administration and how the U.S. and Russia plan to work closer in coordinating bombing targets that focus on Daesh, the Islamic State, and al-Nusra. Then, following a recent article in the Huffington Post by Bernie Sanders, taxpayers funded a life-saving drug, and guess what happened next? We will speak with Frank Clementi, the executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness, who is the lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Gilead Sciences, Price Gouger, Tax Dodger. We will look into this report that is the basis for the Sanders article and find out how a taxpayer-funded drug that treats hepatitis C is now being sold by Gilead for $1,000 a pill, making it the costliest prescription that U.S. public and private insurance taxpayers and patients pay for. Meanwhile, Gilead has dodged paying $10 billion on taxes on the obscene profits it has gouged from the public. Then finally, we will speak with Dr. Azar Abu Dagha, a health services researcher at Public Citizens Health Research Group, who is the lead author of a new report that examines how incarceration has replaced psychiatric hospitalization for thousands of inmates with serious mental illness in America. We will discuss how county jails are ill-equipped to deal with this overwhelming problem that is the result of the closure of state psychiatric hospitals and the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill who have been dumped on the streets and end up in the criminal justice system. And joining us now is Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes the Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
A pleasure, Ian. Good to be with you.
Thank you, Joshua. And what do you make of this leaked memo that the Washington Post obtained? It seems to be, obviously with John Kerry in Moscow as we speak, meeting with and negotiating with Vladimir Putin, it indicates that what they're negotiating is a major shift in U.S. Policy and strategy towards Syria. So, one, do you think it's for real? And two, how much of a major shift is it?
Well, it could be important. The gist of this is that the U.S. is going to cooperate with Russia. They're going to have a control center in Syria where generals from both sides are going to sit together. Their air force are going to work together in order to attack and try to destroy al-Nusra in Syria. Al-Nusra is the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria, which has become quite powerful in the province, the northern province of Idlib, next to the Turkish border. It controls a big hunk of northwestern Syria. And the question is, should that al-Qaeda operation be left integral because it works with many of the opposition groups that America has been supporting in order to destroy or to hurt Assad and the Assad regime? That's the real question. So underneath all of this is a battle about U.S. priorities. Who is the real enemy of the United States and how are they prioritized? Is it Russia? Is it al-Qaeda? Or is it Assad of Syria? And there are people in Washington who would like to prioritize each of those people or groups and countries first. And that's why there is this sort of fist fight going on over policy towards Syria.
And when you say that they're going to, Russians, the Americans are going to have a joint targeting center where American and Russian Air Force generals sit down together and share intelligence, presumably, to target al-Nusra, what about Daesh, the self-declared Islamic State? Are they going to go after them too?
Indeed, and they're already going after them. And Russia and the United States are both bombing the Islamic State, as is the Syrian regime. The United States has refused to cooperate with the Syrian regime on attacking ISIS. On the other hand, they're both attacking them together. And this has formed, in a sense, a shared interest between Russia and the United States. And there are people in Washington who do not think we should go down this road of cooperating with Moscow. They say that Putin is the real bad guy out there. They point to Ukraine and Crimea and so forth, and they say, if we give this to Russia, Russia's going to get a lot. They're going to get out of the doghouse and possibly sanctions and so forth by cooperating with the United States. And what is the United States really going to get out of this? Now, obviously, the people who think al-Qaeda is really the bad guy are going to be delighted with this deal. But those who think Russia is the bad guy and perhaps Assad are going to be furious, because in a sense, Assad gets away. Al-Qaeda is one of his biggest enemies. Al-Qaeda gives the real teeth to the panoply of opposition groups that are fighting against him. And if the United States and Russia take out Al-Qaeda, his entire opposition is going to be very weakened, and it's going to put him in a much better position.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and he writes the Syria Comment blog. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. So clearly, if this deal goes down, Assad will be the winner, and I'm not sure how much morality plays a role in politics. You know, we have this phenomenon known as realpolitik. Throughout the Cold War, we dealt with some extremely nasty people. But this guy is particularly nasty, and everybody recognizes that he's basically destroyed this country because of his. It's considered the family farm, and it's all about privilege and ego, and he doesn't seem to give a damn about how many Syrians die, and most of his country's been ruined already, and I think, 9 million have been displaced, 3 million in Turkey alone. And probably it's getting around, 750,000 or so have been killed. Probably another 250,000 disappeared. So it's an absolute, from a moral point of view, this is really hard to swallow. And I imagine there are some people in the administration that aren't too happy with it. I take it that Secretary of Defense Carter objects to this deal. So he must be speaking for the military. So you say the military are going to sit down with the Russians. Clearly, if the Secretary of Defense is not happy about it, maybe people inside the military and the CIA aren't too happy as well.
Well, I'm sure there is a big division in both institutions, because people are divided over how to attack this extremism. There are those who say the only way to get rid of extremism in the Middle East is to destroy the present regimes that are oppressing people, that extremism comes from oppressive, non-democratic regimes like Gaddafi, Assad, Saddam Hussein. You go down the list. They're all bad. They're all dictatorial. They oppress their people. And that if you don't have democracy, you're going to get extremism. The other half say, forget that. We're not going to produce democracy in the Middle East. Regime change creates a collapsed states, and then extremists expand. You get rid of Saddam Hussein and his state. Today there's al-Qaeda running all over the place and ISIS. Gaddafi, same thing. And they go down that list. So the Americans, both in the military, the intelligence, and so forth, are very divided on how to destroy extremism. Do you keep these bad dictators and hope that they can police the situation, kill the extremists, and keep their people in a box? Or do you help rebels and insurgents kick over the state system and hope that something better comes along? And, you know, also there's a second half of this deal that Kerry is putting forward, which is the United States and Russia by cooperating with Russia, the U.S., what does the U.S. get out of this other than destroying al-Qaeda? They get to prescribe the freedom of the Assad regime. That's what Kerry is touting out of this, is that there will be certain areas where Russia and the United States can bomb, the areas in which Nusra is operating, the areas in which friendly militias to the United States are operating are going to be off limits to Russian and Syrian aircraft. So in a sense, the deal, at least the way that Kerry is putting it forward, is that this will protect U.S.-friendly militias in order to destroy those militias that are trying to hurt the United States and are Salafist and so forth. So, of course, the naysayers in Washington say that's never going to happen. You know, Russia's going to get out of this scot-free. Their Syrians aren't going to be restrained. And this, in a sense, is just a cave-in. So it really is hard to tell. But we can see that there's a sort of, in a sense, a fist fight going on, because the complaint channel in the State Department, 50 people came forward and said, no, we've got to start bombing Assad, and we have to use what they call judicious bombing in order to force him to the table and to make deep compromises and to leave power. And in a sense, others are saying, no, that's the wrong way. If you destroy Assad, you're going to enable al-Qaeda and ISIS and other extremist groups to take over the rest of Syria. And they say, we've got to work with people like Russia and overlook the sins of someone like Assad in order to destroy these extremists who've attacked America. And that's the dilemma. As you say, it's a moral cesspool.
Well, Secretary of State Kerry, who seemed to be in sympathetic to those 55 diplomats in the State Department's dissent channel, nevertheless, he spent the evening negotiating with Vladimir Putin on Thursday night, and tomorrow morning in Moscow he meets with Lavrov to dot the I's and cross the T's. One of the things that I thought they were touting, though, the U.S., because you got to admit, it's a big shift. I mean, remember Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that Assad was finished, and they were, you know, obviously prematurely celebrating his demise. The policy has always been about getting rid of him. He is, I think, by any reasonable measure, responsible for the tragedy that has destroyed his country. And it's either his ego versus the people's lives and well-being of his entire country. It's absolute disgrace what's happened. But I thought that one of the few concessions was that Assad's military air force would be grounded. Not that there's much of an air force, but is that a part of it?
Well, it's not going to be grounded entirely. That's the difficulty. It's going to be restricted to what areas it can fight against. It will still be able to fight against al-Qaeda and ISIS, because Assad is fighting a very desperate battle against ISIS in areas up near Raqqa, Palmyra, in Deir ez-Zor, in many fronts. It's fighting ISIS, and they're fighting Nusra and around Aleppo and Idlib and Latakia. So this is the difficulty. If you ground Assad's forces, Nusra and ISIS are going to take these regions. So America's caught between Scylla and Charybdis here. These are two forces that it doesn't like. In fact, every major power in Syria that could conquer the country, and there are three major powers that could do it today, ISIS, this Nusra-aided Salafist front, which is called Jaish al-Fatah, but Nusra is an integral part of it. That's al-Qaeda. And Assad, all of them, the United States does not like, is trying to destroy in one way or another, whether through sanctions and supporting enemies of each of these powers. So the United States would like to see every major authority center in Syria destroyed. And there's talk about enabling moderates. The trouble is the moderates are splintered into hundreds of little militias, most of them very local, that run a few towns, and it's like herding cats. And this is the difficulty of producing a democratic law-abiding solution to Syria.
And Turkey, which, you know, again, like Secretary of State Clinton, Erdogan was also confident that Assad would go, and he hasn't. And it's so much of Erdogan's foreign policy has blown up in his face. He's reignited the war with the Kurds. He's angered the Russians, who are these big trading partners, etc. And now he's got blowback from ISIS, who he originally supported, and now they're setting off bombs. So I guess where does he come down on this deal, just in the last minute?
Well, he's backing away from his enmity to Syria. His new prime minister just announced 2 days ago that Turkey would reestablish normal relations with Syria. There's some questions about whether that's after Assad leaves or so forth, but Turkey is trying to back away from its war against Assad, largely because it sees a Kurdish state beginning to emerge along its border with Syria. And that state is being supported by the United States because the U.S. has partnered with the Kurds to destroy Islamic State. So this new state is appearing. Turkey doesn't like it at all. And in a sense, they're holding their nose and re-establishing relations with the Assad government, or if not relations, at least they're stopping the assault on the Assad government because they want to make common cause against their primary enemy, the Kurds of Syria and the PKK. So that's, you know, in a sense, I think a lot of powers are coming to the conclusion that Assad is here to stay, that they have lost their fight to destroy him, and they're beginning to see that forces like ISIS, which Turkey had, in a sense, ignored, or Al-Qaeda, which both the United States and Turkey had, if not helped, ignored. And today, they're changing their priorities, and that's causing, as you say, a lot of disturbance and acrimony in Washington, particularly at this time that people are looking forward to a Clinton presidency. I don't think they've wrapped their minds around the notion that Trump might win. But in a sense, a lot of this repositioning is in order to influence the next administration.
Well, just in the last minute there, to touch on the idea that Trump could be president, I share Ruth Bader Ginsburg's alarm at that prospect, as do many people. His the choice for vice president that I'm told Trump really wants is Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. But the party and everybody else, I think, is pushing him into taking Mike Pence. But it's kind of interesting and ironic that Michael Flynn met with Putin and has always argued that the U.S. should cooperate more with Putin against terrorism, etc. So it's sort of interesting in a way, isn't it, that the Obama administration has sort of, I don't imagine they're operating on Michael Flynn's advice, because the guy, I think, was had some major clashes with within the administration. But how do you see that, as that irony?
Well, it is. It's true. And that's what we've seen emerge out of this election cycle, where both Bernie Sanders and Trump have really upset the apple cart on both sides of the aisle. And they've said, we don't want to spend our money abroad. Forget this fight over there in Iraq. We're not going to sort out Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan. We've wasted trillions of dollars. And Trump, I think, has said many times it was a bad deal. That's his line on this. And he does not want to get involved in those wars. He wants to build America, as he says. And that's common with Obama. Obama said the same thing. He was not interested. He wants to get out of the Middle East. And he was more interested in trying to build up the middle class. So I think there has been a real shift, both in the Democratic and Republican Party, away from spending billions, if not trillions of dollars in adventures abroad.
Misadventures. Well, I thank you, Joshua Landis.
The pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into how Gilead Pharmaceuticals gouges patients and dodges taxes. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Frank Clemente, who's Executive Director and Co-Founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. Previously, he was a campaign manager for the Strengthen Social Security campaign and also has been a senior policy advisor to the U.S. House Committee on Government Operations. And he's the lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Gilead Sciences, Price Gouger, Tax Dodger. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Clemente.
Glad to be here, Ian. Thank you.
And Senator Bernie Sanders has an article at the Huffington Post. Taxpayers funded a life-saving drug, and guess what happened next? And it's all about, essentially, you're the source of the report that his article is based on. So let's talk about the report itself. Give us the basics here about how a taxpayer-funded, developed drug that was developed through the Department of Veteran Affairs ended up being acquired by Gilead Sciences, and now it costs $1,000 a pill, which is $84,000 per treatment, which means essentially that the U.S. public and private insurers and taxpayers and patients have to bear the cost, and it is the most expensive drug in the world, according to how much money it costs more than any other prescription. And then on top of all that, Gilead Sciences have dodged nearly $10 billion in U.S. taxes. So it's almost incomprehensible. So how did this happen? Walk us through this disgrace.
Sure. Well, first of all, your listeners might want to know this is a California-based company, Gilead Sciences, and it's the sixth largest pharmaceutical firm in the world, although most people haven't heard of it. And a lot of that, its size, it's grown rapidly over the last 3 years. They purchased from a smaller company a hepatitis C cure, although they didn't know it at the time that it would be so successful. But it's allowed them to dramatically increase their sales in the last 3 years. Their profits have soared nearly as much. And what we found when we looked at their financials is basically all the profits that they are making here in America, they are booking them offshore in tax havens. We think it's in Ireland. We're not sure about that. But basically, most of their sales occur here in America. We have a very large hepatitis C population here. But the way they've structured this, because of the tax loopholes that exist in our system, they're able to, even though the patents are held here in America, they're essentially being domiciled in Ireland. They're running all of the bookkeeping, all the sales through Ireland, and that's why the profits are growing dramatically offshore. And when they're offshore like that, they're not paying any taxes back here to America, even though they have to eventually. So it's a scam operation because the Congress has allowed this tax loophole to exist. And we're getting hit on three sides, and you sort of summed it up. We're paying exorbitant prices for this drug. The cost of manufacturing, the price of this drug is 60 times what it costs to manufacture it. It's a 12-week treatment. We help them discover this drug through federal grants to research it. The guy who was the lead scientist in discovering this worked 7/8 time for the Veterans Administration. He did this drug development on the side, but his VA work was totally related to his drug development of this drug. And now, not only are they price gouging us, not only did we support the development of this drug through research, but they are not paying anything in taxes on these profits they're generating.
So let's begin with the first part of it then, Frank Clemente. How did this drug that was developed with taxpayer money by this researcher who worked at the Department of Veteran Affairs, and he had founded his small drug company, so he was basically doing his research and perhaps even using some of the patients there, but the long and the short of it is, what kind of rules does the government have? If you're a government employer, how can you have the taxpayer subsidize you and then end up owning, did he end up with 100% of ownership of this drug?
Well, he's claiming that the development of the drug wasn't happening on his VA time. In other words, the time that he was working for the Veterans Administration. Instead, he was also he had an arrangement with Emory University in Georgia, and his grants were going to him while at Emory University. So, the grants he was getting were to help develop cures for hepatitis C. He had collaborations with the VA. It's very murky. There's not enough disclosure at the federal government for us to understand what's going on and what the arrangements were, whether there were financial arrangements or anything like that. It's just it's very fishy. We know the government helped fund the research. It also helped fund the testing of the drug. In other words, to determine whether it was useful or not. That was done through the drug company, the Pharmacet, the company that he founded, got a grant from the federal government to test the drug. And there's also the Institute for Allergies and Infectious Diseases, which is a part of the NIH, National Institutes of Health. They were collaborating with him as well. So he's getting various forms of assistance from the federal government. But these things are always murky. And unfortunately, nobody's pursued it to figure out whether the government should have a share of the patent on this thing, or whether they should be getting a share of the profits off of Gilead. But he eventually, it became, he developed the drug through the small company Pharmacet, and he was able to sell that, turn that around. He sold it for $10 billion to Gilead, and what a bargain for Gilead, because they, in 1 year alone, in 2015, they had $32 billion in sales on these hepatitis C cures. So they've made out really well.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Clemente, who's executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. He has been a senior policy advisor to the United States House Committee on Government Operations and is a lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Gilead Sciences, Price Gouger, Tax Dodger. So Bernie Sanders points out in this article that he wrote for the Huffington Post based on the report that you've done, Frank Clemente, taxpayers funded a life-saving drug, and guess what happened next? Now, in this article by Bernie Sanders, the five largest prescription drug companies in the U.S. made a combined $50 billion in profits last year. And this company, how did you rate it? The seventh in the U.S.?
Sixth largest.
So it's within that number, yeah. No, it's not. This is the five largest. So here they are. This guy develops a drug largely on the taxpayer dime, gets federal money to have it tested because unless it's FDA approved, you can't put it on the market. And then he sells his small drug company. Did he sell the whole company for $11 billion to Gilead?
Yeah, the entire company was sold, yes.
Right.
He himself made $400 million off the sale. That's what he pocketed. So he got very rich.
Right. Well, you know, we don't begrudge the wealthy, as you know.
Sure. But
we would like them to be a little more socially responsible and share the wealth.
We don't begrudge them as long as they pay their fair share of tax.
There you go. And that's what the point I wanted to make. So this drug now, Sovaldi, which they made their profits back in less than a year. What were the profits last year? $22 billion, right, in 2015?
Yes, their profits were $32 billion in 2015. The profits were $22 billion. Their sales were a bunch higher than that. But, yes, you're talking about a huge, huge amount of money for this one company.
But again, this money, most of it comes from the taxpayer, does it not? Or anybody that pays for insurance, because who can afford $84,000 for a treatment?
Right. Well, the last year we have data for in 2014, so between Medicare and Medicaid, which are two big public health programs, and the Veterans Administration, the federal government alone spent $5 billion on this drug. So that's a big chunk of it. Then obviously, health insurance, private health insurance pays for it. And your employer pays for your private health insurance, or you're paying for your private health insurance, or you're paying out of pocket for the drug too. A lot of times your insurance won't cover a drug like this. So, they're getting the money from taxpayers one way or another, either through direct support through federal public health programs and Medicaid, the state health, state and federal program, or through consumers or through their insurers. So, you know, this is a company that's getting extremely wealthy off of taxpayers and off of American consumers. And what was the striking finding about this report is that virtually all these new profits, these $22 billion in profits in 2015, it appears that almost all of them are being shoveled off, stashed offshore in tax havens. And the reason that the company is able to do that is the patent is an American patent. It was, but in 2013, they changed what's called the domicile of that patent. It's basically where is it, where is the income from that patent being booked from? And they changed it to Ireland. Essentially, what they did was they sold the rights to use that patent to their subsidiary in Ireland, and then the Irish subsidiary now sells back to Gilead here in America and to other subsidiaries, their other subsidiaries around the world, the right to use that patent, use that license to manufacture the drug. And that way, they take the profits that should be being booked here in America, and they're now booking them in Ireland. And it appears that they've cut a very special deal with the Irish government, because Gilead has reported to the federal government, to the Securities and Exchange Commission, that the profits that they're making offshore, they are only paying a 1% tax rate on those profits. What that means is that the profits are stashed in tax havens. And I think that they're probably almost all in Ireland, because that's who now holds the legal rights to use the patent to sell it to the manufacturers. And so that's how we call it profit shifting. All the intellectual property was developed here in America. American scientists, the American education system helped create this. The American patent system, which protects this, gives the monopoly patent to this company. The financial system, the Food and Drug Administration that approves it, all this infrastructure here in America that developed this drug, they then are able to sell the rights, so to speak, to Ireland, so that all the profits get sucked out of America to Ireland, where they're paying virtually nothing in taxes. Now, technically, under U.S. law, they do have to pay U.S. taxes on those foreign profits, but we have this loophole in the law, it's called deferral, and it allows the company to avoid paying taxes back here in America until it technically repatriates the money. That's a very fancy technical term for that. It brings the money back to the shareholders and distributes it to its shareholders. I guarantee you they brought the money back here, and it's invested in other companies and U.S. treasuries and other kinds of investments. They just haven't brought it back directly to the company itself. So well, it's a very complicated story, I know.
Right, right.
I'm sorry about how complicated it is.
No. But you have to add to this the fact that the CEO of Gilead, John Martin, he pays himself $200 million a year, at least he did in 2014. Probably he's given himself a raise since then. So, you know, he's living over here, right?
Well, he's making his money. I don't know how much they're paying him in cash, right. But they're paying him in stock, right? And the company's value of its stock is gone up dramatically because it's making money hand over fist. And the irony in all this, here's one more intellectually challenging thing about this, what our finding is that, but there is a loophole, another loophole in law, which lets these companies claim that we are subsidizing the compensation in stocks as well. Over the last 3 years, taxpayers have subsidized by the tune of $1.3 billion, their stock options program. Now, if you just get this, here's a guy who's already making a ton of money, and we are subsidizing him further and the other executives there further through the tax system is subsidizing their stock compensation. It's just ridiculous that Congress allows these things to persist.
Well, but the reason that this drug, Sovaldi, cost $1,000 a pill and $84,000 for a treatment is to do with the Congress as well, isn't it? Because didn't the Republicans under George W. Bush forbid the federal government from being able to bargain and bulk buy like any organization. There's a reason why drugs cost more in America than they do anywhere else on the planet. It's because the Congress won't allow the government, which is the largest purchaser of drugs, in this case Medicare and Medicaid, you know, to bargain. They have to pay top dollar.
Right, and that applies for the public health programs of Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA. The VA is getting a break. The VA actually pays quite a bit less than Medicare and Medicaid pay for the same drug. So, although we don't know what the VA is paying for it, but you know, the public health programs are probably only a sixth of the market. So you have you have all the private. Even if they allowed the government to negotiate prices, which they should do, and that would bring the price down at least to the public sector. You still have all the private sector out there, which would still have to pay whatever Gilead says it ought to pay. We actually have a recommendation in the report that says the government ought to, when you have drugs like this that are so exceptional, and this is a life-saving medication, a lot of people die from hepatitis C, and it's a very debilitating disease. Your liver stops functioning, or you get cancer of the liver, and it's a very agonizing death that occurs. And this is a cure. So this is exceptional. It's a cure. It's not just managing your illness. It is a cure. So it only takes 12 weeks to cure. For certain kinds of diseases, there ought to be some different the patent ought to give the government a lot more flexibility to say, well, there's a fair price you ought to be able to charge for this drug, but not an exorbitant price. And we're not even close to getting Congress to create such a law that would allow that to take place. But think about it. I mean, it costs less than $1,500 to manufacture this drug, and they're charging, you know, $84,000 for it. So it's just very the priorities are all off here.
Right. And just in closing, you know, a lot of people went after that dreadful sort of bratty, preppy little creep who bought a drug company and then gouged. I think he put the price of the drug up 5,000-fold. Another life-saving drug, Martin Shkreli, I think his name was. He got a lot of negative Shkreli, right. He got a lot of negative publicity. But this fellow, John C. Martin, nobody's going after him, right, or saying, shame on you.
He's kind of flown under the radar, I know. He's become a billionaire because of this drug. It's unfortunate. But you know what? I think the last thought I'd leave with your listeners is that this is the modus operandi for the drug industry. Because of the patent system, they are able to charge excessive prices, and therefore they make excessive profits. And they are exceptional at dodging taxes because they are able to shift the intellectual property, the patent, in other words, for that drug that was developed here in America. They're free and clear to basically change where it's domiciled, like Gilead did to Ireland. And this is a very common practice by these companies. They're making it look like they're running their profits through offshore tax havens now. They're taking them out of America, so they're not paying their fair share of taxes here. The drug companies and the high-tech companies like Apple and Microsoft and Google, they are the worst corporate tax dodgers out there because their patents are so wealthy, they're worth so much money, and they're able to register them in these foreign countries and run the profits through there. And so we've got to get together and stop both the price gouging and the tax dodging. It's sort of two sides of the same coin. These companies, all American companies, have $2.4 trillion in profits that are sitting offshore right now, on which they owe U.S. taxes, and they're not paying any U.S. taxes on them. We estimate they owe $700 billion in taxes on it. That is a phenomenal amount of money they could do, rebuild our whole infrastructure here in America, change our education system, just do fantastic things for all of us. And we have to have a campaign to get them to bring this money back and pay the $700 billion they owe.
Well, Frank Lametti, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Frank Lametti, who's executive director and co-founder of Americans for Tax Fairness. He has been a senior policy advisor to the United States House Committee on Government Operations and is the lead author of a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness, Gilead Sciences, Price Gouger, Tax Dodger.
outside the patient millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding. This place is a prison, and these people aren't your friends. There's guards at the on-ramps, armed to the teeth.
We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how incarceration has replaced psychiatric hospitalization for thousands of inmates with serious mental illness in America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Azza Abu-Daga, who is a health services researcher of Public Citizens Health Research, where she is responsible for designing and conducting their database research projects related to healthcare access and quality, provider accountability, and serious mental illness in jails. She is the lead author of Public Citizens' new report that examines how incarceration has replaced psychiatric hospitalization for thousands of inmates with serious mental illness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Azza Abu-Daga.
Thank you for having me.
And just a few days ago, the Dallas police chief gave a press conference at which he said that too much is expected of the police. Society expects too much of the police. They expect them to be marriage counselors, dog catchers, school monitors, and psychiatrists. And I take it that this new report of yours really makes it clear that so many of the people in our jails should be getting psychiatric health, not being treated as criminals.
As sad as this sounds, it's actually true. Unfortunately, our mental health system has failed in serving one of the most vulnerable section of our population, which is people with serious mental illness. And that's because, on the one hand, we have severe downsizing or even closure of state psychiatric beds, which is not a new problem. In fact, we've been having this problem in the U.S., and it's actually a problem in other industrialized countries, which began back in the late 50s and early 60s, when treatments for mental illnesses became available, effective treatments became available in the community for the first time. So there was a large push towards moving people in the community and treating them in the community, which was a great idea. It was a humane idea also as well. It was a cost-effective idea, except that the resources needed to treat those people in the community did not materialize. In the U.S., the Community Mental Health Centers Act was enacted in 1963, which authorizes the development of a nationwide network of community mental centers to replace state institutions as a main source of treatment for people with serious mental illnesses. However, like I mentioned, the emptying of state hospital beds has commenced since that time. We're looking right now, as of the first quarter of this year, we're looking at estimates that about 12, there are only 12 state hospital beds per 100,000 population. The comparable number for 100,000 population back in 1955 was about 340 beds. So we've seriously deprived those populations from state beds, which actually are the main source of psychiatric treatment for this population. And actually, other studies prior to our work have documented that there are, like in jails and prisons, county jails and prisons, there are 10 times more people with serious mental illness than in state psychiatric beds. The problem is not specific to certain states or counties or regions. It's actually throughout the United States. And actually, the report that we've done, we've just released today with our partners at the Treatment Advocacy Center, is just follow-up to a 1992 report that we've done on the same problem. The report, the title of that report was Criminalizing the Seriously Mentally Ill. And 20 years later, we're looking at the same problems, the same issues that we've covered in our earlier report, except the problems are worse now.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Azza Abu Daga, who is a health services researcher at Public Citizens Health Research, where she is responsible for designing and conducting their database research projects related to healthcare access and quality, provider accountability, and serious mental illness in jails. She's the lead author of Public Citizens' new report that examines how incarceration has replaced psychiatric hospitalization for thousands of inmates with serious mental illness. Now, your study surveyed 230 sheriff's departments in 39 states. And I take it that a lot of, there is a connection, if you will, between mental illness and petty crime, in as much as mentally ill people are on the streets and they have to forage and survive. And they're often picked up for minor offenses like sleeping in parks and petty shoplifting, etc. So I guess the tragedy here is that, you know, for example, if you commit a murder and you can prove that you're mentally ill, you can get away with murder. But at the lower end of petty crime, the opposite is true. You get incarcerated.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the situation that we have right now, because like you mentioned, those people end in jails just because they commit acts of survival, these are just minor trespassing or shoplifting and things of that sort. A small proportion of these people do commit have criminal charges, but the majority are actually end in jail just because they're simply, when the police encounters them, they have no other option other than arresting them and taking them into custody. And have we the right system, those people would actually not be arrested by the police force. Ideally, the police force should be trained to recognize people with serious mental illnesses. And instead of incarcerating them, they should channel them into community-based treatments, which are programs that actually do not exist for a lot of states. So that's how we end up with the situation. An adult person with a serious mental illness would be arrested, and then they would be incarcerated, and ultimately the jail staff would realize that the person is seriously mentally ill, and even for to do a basic evaluation for them, a large proportion of the jails do not have the infrastructure to do this even basic evaluation. So they would rely on the county and other sources to do this evaluation. And ultimately, those people should be transferred to state jails. But unless the person is in a psychiatric emergency or in a serious crisis, which eventually happens because we incarcerate those people who are not treated, and mostly they're going to be segregated in jails because they pose a risk to themselves or they're likely to be abused by other inmates. When they are incarcerated and they're segregated, their condition exacerbates. They enter into psychiatric emergency, and at that point, and that could be weeks, sometimes months in jails, at that point, they would qualify for a state bed based on an increased acuity of their situation.
Right, but more often than not, these are very traumatized people to begin with. Many of them, from my understanding, are off their meds, which creates a very sort of psychotic condition. And a jail, particularly a jail full of hardened criminals, is about the last place you want to put people that are in this vulnerable state.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, these inmates and actually with other inmates, like you mentioned, in a tiny cell, a 4x8 cell for the most part, and they're likely to be abused, or in the subset of cases, abused by other inmates. So, I mean, the jails are not really equipped to deal with these inmates. The best they can do is just segregate them. In fact, we found that about 60% of the jails reported segregating these inmates, which is not the solution. The real solution actually is providing treatment. And we did ask the jails about whether they provide treatment or medications for these inmates, and just 42% of the jails that we surveyed reported being able to provide these medications, because these medications are expensive, and these are costly as well. So they take a main chunk of the jail's budget as well. Barely about 36% of the jails are able to provide individual psychiatric care for these patients, and like 10% are able to provide group therapy for these patients. So mostly they're housed because simply the mental health care system has failed them. We have failed them because we haven't made, as a nation, we haven't made mental health a national priority. We haven't done that at the federal level, or at the state level, or at the local level. And it's time. It's time with these new data. It's time actually to stop this trend, which is not befitting of our country. It's not befitting of our democracy, because it's time to treat those people. And in fact, these people are treated. Maybe about 25% of the people with serious mental illness need very close supervision and being housed in state hospitals, but actually the vast majority, at least 70% of those inmates, if they are provided the proper treatment, not only they can function in the community, they can also, they can work, they can resume their normal life. Have we have the right system in place, which unfortunately we seem to be far from that stage yet.
Well, it's pretty close to one-year anniversary of the death of Sandra Bland in Texas, who was pulled over by a trooper who was abusive, and he pulled her over for making a lane change, which is almost a non-offense. And then she ended up dead in the prison, allegedly hung herself, and there was a lot of questions about that, a lot of suspicions. But if you take the police version of what happened to Sandra Bland, that she committed suicide, she was obviously somebody that needed mental health attention. And my understanding is that about 1,000 inmates die per year in American prisons. Is that, I may not have an accurate figure on that, but I understand it's at least 1,000.
We haven't looked at that in our study per se, but there are multiple reports of death inside jails, which actually, our system is blaming the jail system, and actually, in part, that's true, because Supreme Court has affirmed a time and after time that the justice system is accountable. They should provide the proper treatment for people with serious mental illness, but at the same time, it's not fair for the justice system. It's not fair for the staff, that for the people who staff these jails, because on the one hand, they're not mental health professionals. They're not trained to provide to care for these inmates. They don't have resources. A person with serious mental illness, and if in terms of having to watch them for suicide, some of our jail respondents, they have to watch them every 15 minutes. And if you have 8 individuals on your staff, if you are going to dedicate at least one of those people just to check on one or two people, people with serious mental illnesses. So it is unfair that these people die in jail. It's a shame on our system. It's also not fair to blame the jails. They should still be accountable. But as a community, as a society, on a national level, we have to address the root cause of the problem, which is, these people do not belong in jails to begin with. Jails should not be the de facto hospitals. They shouldn't be the dumping ground for a failed mental health care system.
And indeed, I should have made the distinction between prisons and jails. And jails, of course, are where people who have been arrested but not convicted go, and prisons are where people who have already been convicted. So it's doubly disgraceful that people in jails who have not been convicted should be mistreated and abused and often lead to suicide or in cases of being thrown in with hardened criminals, perhaps even killed. I thank you for joining us, Dr. Abu Daga.
Thank you for your interest, and thank you for covering this important public health problem.
Well, we thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Asa Abu Daga, who's a health services researcher at Public Citizens Health Research, where she's responsible for designing and conducting their database research projects related to healthcare access and quality, provider accountability, and serious mental illness in jails. She's the lead author of Public Citizens' new report that examines how incarceration has replaced psychiatric hospitalization for thousands of inmates with serious mental illness. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.